friend, he grew up in this building right here, the red and white one. They just sold it. Somebody, they were on fixed incomes, but that's where I used to live, right here. 20th and Bryant, the courts, we used to call it. I used to live on a top floor. This was always mostly just working people. Just working people with all of these factories that used to be here in the city. This used to be a labor town. And all the labor people used to be in these neighborhoods. My friend Don, my son's godfather, used to live in this building right here. And they had to get out of there because the rent went too high. Another friend of mine owned that building. He moved out of there because his father sold that building. This corner right house right here, my grandmother lives in. Right there. She's having trouble with rent right now. I heard from my uncle. My uncle was telling me that they were raising her rent and stuff in this building. Right here. She's in the second flat there.
Which we know we all asked for before. We know we asked for a meeting with the new owner.
And we also asked for her name at the last meeting because I'm the one who asked for her name. Mm-hmm. And he said he couldn't give it out.
Mm. Yeah. All he has to do is stall 6 more days.
Yeah, that's insane.
But you know what? If he stalled tomorrow and tells us,
we're going to go down the
Hawthorne Stone. Let's all just go down the Hawthorne
Stone. We'll go to Hawthorne Stone, okay. And we'll start something
right
there.
Great.
And that way they can't tell us over the phone that blah, 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 well, I can't get this.
Okay,
we want to go down to his office. We'll go to his office and we'll sit there. And we'll say, you call the new owner right now and see what she says about coming down to meet us right now. You know, that way it would put more pressure on it. If he calls the new owner and, he might say, oh, well, she wasn't there or something like that. But, you know, somebody else
is going, she's out of town. She's, of course, out of town.
That's right. Right.
The new owner is on a vacation all of a sudden.
That's right.
You know, that's what's going to happen. Or something similar.
Welcome everybody to this week's episode of Left Reckoning 51. Joined as always by my good friend Matt Leck. How's it going, brother?
It's going good. I think we were both right in the audio.
We both get we're good. The
doing
music
over
is,
the
is,
faders.
Yeah, we're both manually moving the fader down. In sync, though. It's beautiful. I think that was very smooth. Well, everybody, really stoked to be here tonight. We got a hell of a lot to get to this evening, so we'll jump right into it. We're going to be talking in a little bit with Marshall Steinbaum about the neoliberal lies and misinformation that is sort of propagated to argue against common sense policy, which is mass student loan debt cancellation. Later in the evening, we'll also be joined by Bob Leibel, who is running for Travis County Commissioner. A very, very important office, even though it might seem a little bit obscure. We're going to be talking to him about how to make sure that Austin and Travis County remains a community and a place for the working class, a little bit about the deals that have brought organizations like Tesla to town, and how we can organize collective democratic power for a much, much brighter future. I can't promise it, but I've heard some rumors that a little Jordan Peterson might be making a little bit of an appearance midway through the program as well.
Oh, yeah, I can't wait. And we might, maybe in the post game, we'll talk a little bit about Jordan Peterson's new approved diversity expert. Jordan Peterson has some interesting things that climate scientists may not have thought of.
Ooh.
The world's scientists all put down their pencils, took their stethoscopes out of their ears, and are like, wait a second, this guy may have just solved something for us. What is everything we're doing futile in a sort of Jungian metaphysical way? I guess we'll find out.
Climate scientists have yet to slay the chaos dragon within themselves. And we got a hell of a lot more coming for folks in the post game. Remember, we now have a phone line up and running to take people's voicemails. So you can get access to that line by joining us at patreon.com/leftreckoning. It's always fun to hear from all of y'all. But yeah, I mean, we want to start the show up, revive old TMBS segment. Mainstream media is not really covering this that much, but we want to start with a shout out. You know, there's a lot of talk in this country about, you know, the vaccine mandates, et cetera. It sort of, you know, sucked up all of the oxygen around, you know, the debates around COVID to such an extent that people are forgetting the fundamental issue, which is that there is a global vaccine apartheid going on right now. The United States, if they are serious about ending this pandemic, should one be doing a hell of a lot more domestically, but internationally are completely dropping the ball. And as it's been time and time again, it has fallen on the shoulders of this tiny island nation to stand up for the vast majority of people. Matt, could you take us through this? Because I can't follow the screen.
Yeah, we got Progressive International here highlighting Progressive International delegating is working with Cuban doctor, scientists, and government officials to help vaccinate the world. Cuba announced yesterday that it would share its vaccines and solidarity prices to extend its medical grenades. Here's a short video from Progressive International, who should have more followers. And I might need to refresh.
Oh, Lord. They're throttling us.
Yeah. Hold on, I'll be right back with that.
No worries. I mean, it's an incredible. It's been an incredible movement from the Cuban government to one produce a vaccine that works without the kind of resources that the major pharmaceutical companies were receiving in the first place. But two, to distribute that amongst their own people, and now to distribute that across the globe.
The Progressive International delegation to Cuba landed this week with a simple mission: to help vaccinate the world. 2022 began with a tsunami of COVID-19 cases crashing over the world. According to the World Health Organization, this is the most we have seen of COVID-19 cases since the beginning of the pandemic. The Omicron variant is reported to have more mild implications for vaccinated patients, but the world remains perilously and violently unequally undervaccinated. We're talking 80% of people in Europe who've received two doses of the vaccine, at least, and only 9% of people in low-income countries who've received a single dose. This not only presents problems for those under-vaccinated countries for whom Omicron is a death sentence for hundreds of thousands of people, it also presents the very real possibility, if not inevitability, that new variants will emerge that are more deadly than Omicron and spread across the world, even to the global north countries themselves. The global north refuses to plan for global vaccination, or even to meet their own pledges. They've delivered only 14% of the pledges they've made to COVAX, the UN Global Vaccine Sharing Institution. In that vacuum of global solidarity, Cuba has emerged as a powerful vehicle, an engine of international solidarity and vaccine internationalism more broadly. Not only did Cuba, against all odds, against the US embargo, succeed to develop several vaccine candidates, two of which have an effectiveness of over 90%, they succeeded through the public health system here to roll out a public vaccination program for over 90% of the residents of this island. Now, Cuba stands ready to help vaccinate the world, to export that Cuban model, sending delegations of doctors, of scientists to help build infrastructure in other parts of the world, to build capacity, and to deliver the kind of vaccination programs that Cuba has seen here on the island. The US blockade stands in its way, not only in terms of importing goods like syringes or basic medical necessities to develop and roll out their own vaccination program, but critically for the exports that would enable Cuba to help deliver on this vaccination program. That's why the Progressive International is here, to meet with Cuba's leading doctors and scientists, to hear from them and to help them communicate to the world about what is the Cuban model of vaccination, what can we learn from it, and how can other countries have the access to the same types of vaccines that Cuba has succeeded to.
It's a humanitarian crisis that we're facing right now. Joe Biden should lift the blockade against Cuba. The continuation of the hoarding of medical equipment and knowledge by the United States and the West in general needs to end. One, because it's immoral in the first place, but two, if we're ever going to see the end of this thing, we need to have global solidarity and not this kind of forced isolation that is put on through American imperialism.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what it's about. This is really about, they don't want to share the know-how of how to produce this stuff worldwide. right? Mm-hmm. Like you talk about, like the patents are one thing, and you know that's like Bill Gates and those folks standing in the way of that. And then there's the further thing where, like Adler mentions, Cuba's going there to help create some of that infrastructure that's needed too. And you know, we talk about like aliens visiting planet Earth, and like if they are coming now, one of the reasons would be probably the fucking perversity spectacle that they have of our global public health system right now, where we have a country the size of Cuba having to pull above its weight and being fucking stood in the way of to do so, as the entire globe, you know, just allows this thing to just roil through populations of folks. And it sucks. Cause you mentioned the conversation domestically in America. It's like, Omicron's nothing because everyone's vaccinated who wants to be or whatever, supposedly. But it's like, that's also, I don't know, that's not the case, right? Everywhere else. Mm-hmm. And also the, sure. I think, compared to Delta, Omicron, good news, relatively speaking. Who knows if that's the last fucking variant we deal with? And we're fucking playing footsie with, I think, horrible probabilities here. Like, I don't think it's like likely that we have a Station 11 situation, collapse society, but like we are pushing up against like 3,000. What we've decided in this country, is, doctor said, like at the peak flu season, we usually get about 3,000 deaths. And so that's basically what we can tolerate here in America with regards to COVID deaths. But that's like not seasonal, right? Just every week we tolerate that. And, you know, it's led to a situation where we're losing a lot more than that. And surprised, I don't know. It's frustrating.
Well, the point is that the Cuban model shows that another model is not only like feasible hypothetically, but in practice. And the only thing that's stopping us from pursuing that is the religion of profit. And that's something that desperately, for everyone's sake, needs to be dispelled.
Yep.
Well, on this, let's move on to another crisis that everyone is very well aware of, and unfortunately there hasn't been that much of a response to. I'm talking about the housing crisis. You know, personally, I'm somebody who knows what it's like to not have a home, to not have that kind of security, and I know what that feels like, the kind of desperation and fear and willingness to do anything to make sure that you're able to survive the next week, the next month, right? That's something that stays with you forever. Unfortunately, that's not an experience that is unique to me. It's something that many, many people in this country experience on a regular basis. And we're going to talk a little bit about housing in general and some of the solutions, that are out there for dealing with this crisis. But I'll tell you right now that we titled this segment, Could Public Housing Be the Next Medicare for All? And just as an outline, I'm going to argue it absolutely can be and it should be. One, because it's the right policy in the same way that Medicare for All was the right policy, but it touches so, so many people that I think that the organizing capacity around housing, around, you know, renter's justice, tenant justice, et cetera, really has an opportunity to mobilize people in a way that a lot of other issues can't, especially because it has such a universal background. But we'll break all this down. Let's start a little bit with people's image of public housing in general. When most people think of public housing, they don't think of comfort. They think of underfunded, overpoliced, and surveilled structures. That's by design. It does not have to be this way, and we'll go through some of the other models that show that not only can public housing be much better than it is in the United States, it can actually be beautiful, expressive, and something that the communities take pride in. The war on public housing, like many of the other kind of wars on social goods in this country, started really with the birth of neoliberalism when they were coming out after all of these different public goods. There is no need that public housing need to be neglected and underfunded in the way that it does. And as I was saying a second ago, it can be a bedrock of our community, a symbol, frankly, of our community's wealth and collective prosperity. Breaking down just like what we've seen during this pandemic, in 2021, we saw rents increase nearly 11.4%. the eviction lab, which follows evictions, and it's quite a dark job to do right now as more and more people are being forced out of their homes, as these protections that went in during the pandemic are sort of lifted across the board. They've reported that since March 2020, 707,706 people have been evicted. That's an astronomical number. And remember, there's so much that goes into housing justice, you know, not just getting people in housing, but also getting rid of these black marks that get put on renters, you know, where if you get evicted, that stays on your record. It makes it harder and harder for you to secure housing in the future. That's a substantial amount of people, and it never should have happened in the first place. Just last week, there were 8,020 evictions, and just in Houston alone, there were over 2,000 filings for evictions last week. We all know the stats at this point that, you know, minimum wage workers can't afford to live practically anywhere in this country. But this is one of those things where we can go through all the numbers, but it's something that most people are familiar with. If not immediately, the people, they know people around them who are very much struggling to stay in their homes and are seeing more and more of their income being gobbled up by rent. This, unfortunately, is not a new phenomenon in this country, which is why we're going to talk about a very specific solution to this problem, which is social housing, versus some of the kind of more progressive and liberal solutions to these problems. Not that those things aren't worthwhile in supporting, right? And not that just also advocating for an increase in housing stock in this country isn't worth supporting on some level. But you have to understand that the profit motive ends up gobbling up all of these kind of, you know, of all of these other intentions that you may have. I mean, you know, we've seen what happens when you just sort of pursue building for building's sake. You see it in cities like New York, you see it in cities like Austin, you see it in cities like San Francisco, where certainly there are the NIMBYs, right? but this is a very classic thing that we do in this culture, where we find a social problem, right? And instead of actually addressing the root cause of this problem, the root cause of this problem is private ownership of housing at the expense of public ownership of housing. And we come up with the villain and a kind of cheap answer and a cheap solution to this. When you look at what ends up happening with a lot of these new buildings that that are built up across the country, the vast majority of them are for people at the very, very top end of the income bracket. Because if you are trying to make money from a space, you want to maximize the amount of profit that you can get. Right. And we try all these really cute and clever schemes where we say you have to have this much at market rate. But what we've seen, people find loopholes and these market rate thresholds in the first place are not adequate, you know, for what we need. Again, I'm not saying not to develop new housing where it's needed. There's lots of parts of the country where there is too many single family homes and not multifamily housing. I'm not saying that, you know, the kind of generalized criticisms of people who are against any kind of new development in general are incorrect. But I'm going to tell you right now that the NIMBY, if you are sitting here and listening to this crisis and thinking about this crisis, and you think that the sole problem are these, you know, quote unquote NIMBYs, you've been sold a lie. Because this is a very, very old problem in this country. And we have this video, unless you had anything you wanted to add to that, Matt.
I would just comment briefly on, like, as something, the new Medicare for All. Like, we've seen success from people do the, you know, we talked to GP Jacob in Minneapolis. St. Paul was very successful at getting people to turn out for rent control. Robin Wunsey Warloba on the city council, pushing that in Minneapolis. And also Julia Salazar here in New York, was a tenant organizer before she ran, on like a DSA back ticket. And like, and I just say, like, the Minneapolis experience particularly proved to me that, like, when you actually are knocking doors and talking about what people are concerned about, surprise, it's all this shit that bubbles up in all these cultural, you know, like you said, like the NIMBY sort of, like that sort of cultural shit. But there's an actual concern there that needs to be met.
Yeah. And again, like, and even with the NIMBY thing, just to be really explicit on this too, y'all, again, the NIMBY thing, the NIMBY thing obscures why there's a tension, between people who want, you know, more multifamily housing, versus single family housing. And that's property values. That's profit motive, right? Again, like if you're getting fixated on this kind of cultural current, right? This character in your head, the NIMBY, right? And not, oh, housing for profit creates contradictions, you know, for people in general. You are making a big mistake.
Yeah, two contradictions. All right, one diction here. Housing should be a place where people live and shelter them. The other diction, housing is an asset that you want to appreciate and value so you can like get out of this hellhole of America, right, where you can't pay for healthcare and education, right? Those are the two contradictions, and you have to pick one. And mm-hmm. we've picked one, and it's been that's an asset that is going to and that's why you see homelessness, right? Like that's the decision we are making actively.
And let's play this real quick. This is what I believe from the 70s in San Francisco, a city that, you know, very much has been at the front lines of this conflict for a long while. And this is getting really clearly, I think, into the problem of the profit motive when it comes to housing.
There's a new look to San Francisco. On the heels of the Manhattanization of downtown, speculation in housing is changing the face of the city. Rapid and repeated turnovers of residential property are driving up rents, and many San Franciscans find they can't afford to live in their own neighborhoods. The Mission District, one of the few low-rent areas left in the city, is currently a target for speculators. Attracted by low property values and proximity to downtown, speculators buy buildings cheap, make cosmetic repairs, and sell them quickly for huge profits. A recent survey of the Mission found that apartment buildings changed hands on an average of every 18 months, and the biggest profits were made when property was turned over in less than a year. Buildings are bought and sold to maximize profit without regard for their use.
And that right there is the fundamental contradiction between, to use some Marxist terms, the use value and the exchange value, right? And the use value, as Matt was noting earlier, a space for people to live, to reproduce social life, to come home to at the end of the working day, to be a shelter, right? A concept that most people can understand. And the other use of the exchange value of the unit, which is something that you use to hold as an investment to make profit from when you're able to sell it, you know, for more. And like at the end of the day, what we've seen in cities all across this country, and again, you know, actually, I don't want to make this seem like it's just an American problem, which again, I think goes to show that all the people who try to make it a cultural, you know, argument, again, are like making a very big mistake, because it's London, it's Paris, it's Moscow, it's, you know, it's Seattle, it's New York, it's Austin, Houston, et cetera, right? This is a fundamental problem. And there has been influx of, you know, asset price inflation when it comes to housing, especially over the past 20 years. And the main factor, we'll get into that in a second, has been that interest rates have been very, very low, which allow organizations to basically be able to buy up large amounts of housing, which for the most part is, you know, it's not a sure bet, but it's a pretty safe investment. I'll tell you, down the road for me, Austin is certainly another city that's in a housing crisis, and we need way more affordable housing, and I would argue social housing being built here. But what you're seeing being built is these kind of high-end luxury apartment buildings. More often than not, they sit empty because people use them as you know, as investment properties to then try to sell as the market continues to inflate more and more around here. I live in a very working class part of Austin, actually very close to a kind of like warehouse district. A large section of that has been bought up by a bunch of developers, and they're going to be building these luxury condos, which is ridiculous in this neighborhood, you know, when people don't typically live in these kind of fancy places. The average price for these is $350,000 a year for a condo, right? Again, this is a place where you can get a house. A condo for $350 is ridiculous. $350 and more, that's like the, you know, the one bedroom versus like the you know, the suite. It sold out every unit in it before they put a shovel in the dirt, right? I mean, it's just gravel over there right now. This to me shows that there is a huge disconnect again between like the social value of building and the exchange value, right? What people are hoping to make out of it from, you know, from selling it in the future. You're muted, man. I'm sorry.
When you have developers so in charge of like municipal governments, for instance, what are the, what's their incentive? Is there incentive to build a whole bunch of adequate housing for people so like we're going to get an adequate supply for people? No, it's to not. It's to build certain kind of stuff that they can, like you say, like appeal to the inequality of society and get some of that big luxury rent spent.
Well, exactly. And also like this is, you know, people always like to use terms like we're going to do capitalism with a conscience, right? You remember that one, the Whole Foods CEO. This is one of those things when you have a system that prioritizes a certain kind of activity, right, which is making money. People who are in that business are going to try to make as much money as possible. As I said earlier, if you own a property, you're going to try to be able to take as much value out of that, to take as much profit out of that as possible. You don't care about what the social value of that is to the community. You're capitalist. You're in this kind of thing to get paid. And this is why the model that we've taken in neoliberal America has failed dramatically at this problem. There has been issues with us being able to increase the housing supply, but also this fantasy that we're going to get the market to work for us. You know, we really need to disabuse people of that model. So you can just, you know, briefly, in the United States, there's a sort of exciting moment with public housing. It doesn't take off in the same way that it did in Europe. Very soon, though, government-owned housing, you know, buildings that the government is making to then rent out at lower rates than market rates to people, and that starts to decline as more and more people are sort of pushed into Section 8, right? Which is a system where you're essentially subsidizing low-income working-class people to pay potentially a nonprofit, but more often than not, a private, an owner of a private building, right? Again, and this is the kind of thing, you're just locking people into that kind of system, which has had this effect across the board in this country where rents continue to go up despite wages staying stagnant and rent gobbling up more and more and more of people's income. Let's get to the solution here because it's very simple, but there's an important argument to be made. The solution is public and social housing. What do we mean by this? It means that we are having housing that is owned by the government, by the community, the extension of us as members of a democracy. And those, they could be different institutions. It could be the state. It could be the city. It could be the federal government. I would prefer to see, you know, a model of all three with more and more of federal funding going in to foot the bill. And we'll talk about the ways that that can be done later. Because I'll tell you right now, while we see some kind of pathways potentially in New York and California, it's going to be a very long time before you're able to get state governments, I think, across the South and Texas, places that really, really need it, that kind of influx to do it. So we need to have an approach that is hitting on municipal, state, and federal funding. But let's get into social housing right now. There was an essay that was put out by the People's Policy Project in 2017. I'm going to pull it up right quick for y'all. Put out by Ryan Cooper and Saoirse Gowan, whose name I think I pronounced correctly. I apologize if I didn't. Called The Solution is Social Housing. And this is an excerpt from their longer piece in the People's Policy Project. But this is, they make a strong argument here. So let me read a little bit from it. Many American cities face a severe shortage of affordable housing, and not just for the poor, but well up into the upper middle class. A recent report from Harvard's Center for Housing Studies concluded the rental market thus appears to be settling into a new normal where nearly half of renter households are cost burdened or paying more than 30% of their income in rent. Damn, 30% sounds nice. What those cities need is a dramatic increase in the number of mid-range and affordable dwellings to ease the price pressure on the rental markets. They should address the problem directly by constructing a large number of government-owned municipal housing developments. Unlike traditional American public housing, all city residents will be eligible to live there. And this is the bit that's really important about social housing. As I opened up with, the public housing system in this country failed dramatically. It failed because it wasn't ambitious enough. It failed because neoliberal politicians and right-wing politicians wanted to use it as a place to surveil and punish the poor for being poor. But it also failed because these problems were not universal. These solutions were not universal. And you look at American history, when we don't pursue universal programs, there is a lot of openings for scapegoating and undermining of the core value of these solutions. So laying out the argument that they make in this piece here, we need to see in cities more mid-range and affordable dwellings. No doubt about that. How can we do that is by constructing large numbers of government-owned municipal housing developments and making those eligible to everybody. So you would apply to live in the social housing, and depending on the income, you know, how much money you make, your rent would be adjusted accordingly. So if you are an upper middle class person or a middle class person, you might be paying a little bit more than your neighbor, but you would still be paying less than the market rates in general, right? This kind of system allows for cities, one, to be able to raise the revenues to maintain those programs, and allows us to subsidize the housing for those who really, really need that extra bit of help, while also providing a new stock of affordable housing for the vast majority of people. The system that we have right now is all about creating high-end apartment buildings that, as we were saying earlier, are typically only used as investment properties, or for the people, or in the people who actually are living in them, are people who are. It's not a system that we've seen that really trickle down to the rest of us, right? We haven't seen in areas where they've increased the luxury housing supply, typical housing and apartments in those communities becoming more affordable for people. In fact, we've seen quite the opposite. So what we need is a system that increases the supply, right, but also provides us a mechanism to make sure that it's normal people, middle class people, working class people who are living in them. And the system is very, very simple. There are versions of this all around the world, the most famous obviously being Vienna, where I believe something like 60% of people live in social public housing, right? And again, you pay it as a percentage of your income. So some people pay more, some people pay less. But the housing that they have there is absolutely beautiful. People have a stronger sense of community, and we're able to be much, much more creative with their space.
That's amazing. I didn't know Vienna had that. Vienna, that notorious hellhole.
Well, I mean, that's the good, that's what happens when you have 100 years of socialist movements here. But we'll get into the politics in just one second. I mean, if you want to introduce this this clip we have, Matt, I think that...
Well, we got two. So this has gotten attention from our friends on the right. The right is in disarray, if you can believe it, over the issue of housing being bought up by capitalists. Here is Will Witt. He's a PragerU's, new boy.
Little genius boy.
He's a really smart kid. And they shared this, which was, I noted this. This is interesting coming from the right. Your future in America is being destroyed and controlled by hashtag BlackRock. And there was this cultural husbandry. All these weird right-wing sort of accounts, like cultural husbandies. BlackRock is buying every single family house they can find, paying 20 to 50% above asking price and outbidding normal home buyers. Oh, why? First of all, why are they asking above the asking price? I get that they can because of what we're going to talk about, but it seems like an oversight. But why are corporations, pension funds?
Well, yeah. because when they sell it later, they say this is how much it was bought for.
Gotcha, smart. And so here is Ben Shapiro.
And also, just so people understand the mechanism, they also buy a bunch in the neighborhood. So right. Then it's like, oh, this neighborhood is really hot. The price of housing in this neighborhood has gone up 20%, and then it's BlackRock or one of the real estate, Zillow or one of them was also doing this, I believe, too.
Right. That, I didn't hear about that one. So here's Ben Shapiro taking Will Witt to task. I mean, he doesn't say it by name, but you can tell that this is what this is aimed.
Honestly, you're seeing people get ticked off at corporations for doing what exactly it is that they do, which is they see a cheap debt instrument available to them, and they immediately start taking out loans and then buying up hard assets. Now, there are people who get angry at the corporations for this. You're getting angry at the wrong people. I may not like it either, but the point is that unless you stop the Federal Reserve from pumping money into the system, corporations are going to take cheap loans, and then they're going to use those loans to arbitrage. They're going to take the loans at 0%, and then they're either going to lend it out at 3%, or they're going to go buy hard assets they think are going to appreciate at 3% or more over the course of the next 50 years. This is leading to massive price inflation, especially in real estate. So there's a big story that came out yesterday, and a lot of people right, left, and center are really mad about it. And this is where populists go wrong, not because they are wrong in being angry about things, but because very often they're angry at the wrong people. Okay, it is not a corporation's fault if cheap loans are available, that they are taking the cheap loans and then going and buying real estate, any more than it would be their fault if cheap loans are available and they go and they take the cheap loans and then they buy stock. Okay, it is the fault. This all comes down to government policy. If
what do you say, David?
Well, I'll say this. I don't think that you should save your moral fire, you know, hold your moral fire against BlackRock or any company that is doing things to inflate prices of socially needed goods. But you know what? Ben is onto something here. That is what business does. And that is why business and capitalism is a predatory institution on social goods in our society. But no, Ben is again, he's wrong about saying that you shouldn't be upset or mad at BlackRock, because you should be. But if you're trying to appeal to BlackRock, like you're going to get really mad at BlackRock, and BlackRock's going to say, oh, well, we're going to stop being an entity that is about making profit. You know, you're absolutely delusional. And again, Ben, of course, is trying to turn this on the government. I'll tell you right now, the solution to this problem is very simple. Yes, the reason that we have seen all of these big firms buying up the vast majority of housing stock in this country is because interest rates are low, and it's a pretty safe bet that these kind of values are going to appreciate. So guess what? Instead of sitting on our asses and complaining about it, we could come up with a solution. We should be utilizing interest rates from the Federal Reserve and having that funding being delivered directly to municipalities and government organizations to buy up housing stock across the country, to buy up land across the country, and to build on that land big, beautiful social housing that provides homes to many and value to our communities, because it means that more and more people can continue to live in our society. And it allows us to do something that is very, very good: planning. We can plan communities, and we can have, areas and cities be designed in a much, much more orderly way, where you have housing and business and having more like town centers and things like that, instead of, God love it, but instead of big freeways and, kind of Houstonification of parts of the country, right? So again, Ben is obviously a bad actor, and he's trying to get you to turn to say like, oh, what we need is less regulation here. And if we had less regulation, then things would be better. And the market will work its way out eventually if you get rid of, cheap interest rates from the Federal Reserve. One, the end result of that is disastrous. Thank God that we have a system of central banking in this country. It does not work for working people, but boy, it prevents massive, massive financial collapse. If you look at the history of early America, every time you had one of these kind of recessions, it turned into a full-blown depression. And again, we can make the Federal Reserve and these systems work more for us than they do, but this kind of right-wing desire to absolutely smash them, frankly, is suicidal. But secondly, what we should be advocating for is smart use of these kind of the ability of the federal government to be able to provide all of these kind of loans. I mean, think about how much money was given out to corporations through the Paycheck Protection Program. And I don't know, Bronco Marchicic wrote a really great piece in Jacobin noting just how wasteful that program ended up being, because the vast majority of people who were taking out those loans weren't utilizing them to make sure that people were staying in their jobs. They were using them to line their pockets, right? We have incredible capacity, is what I'm saying, as a as a government and a system to put money into the system, but it always seems to go to the same kind of people. So as people in this democracy, as people in the society, we need to be building the political movements to demand these things. And again, I think that these have a lot of potential to do a lot of good and create a lot of kind of good radical social change, but these aren't that radical of ideas, frankly. Like, this is just good policy. We have a housing crisis, we have the funding mechanism, and we can provide people with housing in a way that helps out everybody, provides jobs for people to be able to work those buildings, provides jobs for people to be able to build those buildings. We can make those buildings green, right? Like, the possibilities are endless. This could be a massive win for Joe Biden and the Democrats. Now, of course, they'll never do it unless there are mass social movements that are demanding it. And this is why, going back to the, you know, the opening title of this clip, you know, housing is one of those things where the pain that we see, the houselessness that we see, the suffering that we see is a choice. We have the solutions. We have the capability to do something different. All we need is to force those in power to respond to these kind of these demands. And what we can do in the meantime is make these arguments very, very clear to folks, right? Because it's very simple. And it's not that crazy. I think most people can wrap their heads around why social housing makes sense and how we can do it and how we can do it in the immediate future, not like 20 years down the line living under socialism. You could do this under the system that we have today. And two, the most immediate thing that you can do is to join your local left-wing organization or tenant union, because mm-hmm. I know organizations from Socialist Alternative to DSA are already out there organizing for these kind of things in their community, right? These are the ways that we can start to build different models and different ideas and different horizons for people, and we absolutely need to be taking advantage of them.
Yeah, Kansas City Tenants also got a really good group going there, stand up for against evictions. And one thing that should be mentioned is, you know, the Ben Shapiro saying, like, oh, these corporations, they just have to take all the money. And it's, you know, Barack Obama, one of the worst things on his domestic legacy is his response to the housing crisis mm-hmm. that saw people evicted en masse when there were absolute policy things that he himself promised. The cram down was one thing, but this entire money funnel you're talking about that we just spray at banks, we could have put that to use for homeowners like you're talking about, and we decided to do it for the banks. And that's why we should be mad at banks also, yes. Right? Right. Like, this idea that we should just be mad at the government, that's the boss speaking through little Benny Shapiro's mouth, because this is all bankers and how they control the government. Anyways.
Yeah. And like, there's so much, I mean, again, there's so many different models we can pursue. I still think socially controlled in the form of municipal state, and federal government is the way to go. Community land trusts are an option. I know a lot of people in New York have been trying to pursue those, that as a way to start building these kind of social housing. I mean, these are things that we can do. I do think that we need to have the big money, cannons and faucets, and basically have as much state capacity and power to implement that as possible. So, again, I'm happy to see any other models as long as they're, feasible, but I do think that trying to take the big guns and using those is the best way to move forward. But again, this is a really exciting opportunity that's out there. It comes out of a very dark problem. But this is the way that I think, a lot of people ask us, like, what can we do to get involved? And I always say, join a socialist organization. I would highly suggest joining the DSA. And two, start thinking about what the needs are in your community. And I think at this point, I can confidently say that there probably is not a community in this country. We're talking about housing justice in these kind of big and bold ways. Isn't something that can get people motivated to seeing politics as an avenue, as a potential place to change their lives for the better. Right. And this is the kind of thing that, instead of sitting on our asses after a big defeat with, Bernie and a lot of the kind of strategies that we pursued in the 2010s and in that decade, this is how we can start to think of different ways to organize our power to be able to fight for a much better future.
Absolutely.
Well, we got a lot. We're going to talk a little bit in just 1 second. We'll be moving over to Marshall Steinbaum talking about why student loan debt cancellation is a good thing and why all of the people arguing against it, especially people who are trying to make these kind of pseudo class-based arguments, are full of shit.
Yeah, I'm here from the Brookings Institution with my Princeton degree to tell you that actually debt relief is just for Paris Hilton, actually. But yeah, another thing that should be decommodified is education.
And then later in the show, we're going to be talking to Bob Leibel about a very exciting campaign here in Travis County about ways that we can use the institutions that already exist to make sure that our communities can stay accessible to working class people. Just want to do a quick pitch. We're going to have our bonus episode on Sunday. You want to introduce that, Matt?
Yeah. Let me get back. We're going to be talking about this new book on genetics that's come out. And it's sort of bringing up old sort of bell curve echoes. And so we're going to be talking about Kevin Bird. He's a Michigan State PhD candidate who writes on, he's been published in, for instance, the American Journal of Physical Anthropology about why this keeps recurring, like hereditary. Well, I think we can kind of know why this keeps recurring. We're going to talk about Stephen Jay Gould, who put the kibosh on a lot of these sort of racial intelligence, race science bullshit in the 80s, and why there's a sort of attack on him. We're going to debunk some debunkers, which is always our favorite thing to do here. Some people trying to debunk Stephen Jay Gould, and no, we're going to step to him. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to get that. I'm looking forward to talking with Kevin.
Yeah, and you'll also get access to the post game where we got a lot more exciting stuff coming. And we need your voicemail, so be sure if you can find that number on patreon.com/leftreckoning. Give us a call, and let's hear from you in the post game coming up right after this show.
All right, and here is Marshall, folks. We'll see you on the other side. And joining us once again, one of the early Left Reckoning guests is, or maybe that was the old late TMBS guest. I'm kind of getting my timelines mixed
up. No, I think we did it on LR.
Was it LR? Okay, cool. He's an assistant professor of economics at the University of Utah and Jane Family Institute Senior Fellow of Higher Education Finance. Marshall Steinbaum, thank you so much for joining us again.
It's great to be back.
So what prompted your return or for me to reach out for you is this, Justin Wolfers, not one of my favorite economists, tweeted out this study by Brookings Institution. And I just want to share a little bit of it because I was looking at this and I still can't quite understand the graph that they purport to show that if we relieved student loan debt, it would be a regressive policy and it would basically just help like yuppies, I guess is sort of the implication. So, but actually before I share this graph, Marshall, what is the current like status of the student loan debt, situation in America? What is that? How does that emerge historically? Is this something we've always dealt with back in colonial times? Or is this a new thing? And how does that compare internationally?
Sure. Well, as you may have heard, there's a lot more student debt in the United States now than there used to be, even in the relatively recent past. So now we're north of like $1.7 trillion in outstanding student loans. The student loan program has been steadily growing since the 1960s or so, but it kind of took a huge increase in significance around the 2000s, coinciding with declining state funding for public higher education institutions, which educate the vast majority of students at both the undergrad, well, the vast majority of the undergraduate level, I think a small majority, a slight majority in the graduate level in this country. So loss of state funding meant that institutions had to adopt higher tuition policies in order to replace the lost revenue and basically keep going at the same size they had been, and in fact increasing in their size and footprint in many cases. And they have in effect moved from being a public funding, public good type model to private funding, or at least notionally funded through private student tuition, which is then backstopped by federal student loans. So in effect, like the same way if you go to a car dealership and want to buy a car but can't come up with, you know, whatever tens of thousands of dollars it is to buy a new car on the spot, you can get an auto loan. And it didn't take that long for car companies to figure out that it was a good idea to have a bank attached to them so that they could approve their own customers for loans to buy this very expensive product right off the bat, so they could vastly increase the set of customers who were in the market for such a large purchase. The same is true in higher education, except instead of the bank being attached to the universities, that might give them some pause in when it comes to extending uneconomic loans, that bank is attached to the federal government, especially since, the feds had been subsidizing private institutions to originate student loans for many decades up until the Great Recession, the financial crisis of 2008-2009. Since then, new student lending has been more or less solely the province of the federal government. And their federal government's view is that more people going to college and going to college for longer and getting more degrees is good for the economy. That's the basic mindset of the Department of Education. And so they've originated loans more or less without limit and with decreasing limits as time has gone on. The other big piece of the student loan puzzle is that employers have been requiring more higher education and more degrees to get a given job. So, whereas it was once the case that you could enter the labor market without having touched the higher education system, as that system has become more private and more exploitative, it's also become, in some sense, more universal that people have some experience of it before entering the labor market. And this is why it's not just wrong, but offensive to paint student debt as solely the province of a wealthy elite or yuppie type class, as you correctly alluded to this Brookings Institution publication. You asked where student debt currently stands. I mean, that's, you know, kind of the big picture overview. We've had a pause on loan repayments since the start of the pandemic. So the federal government basically, by fiat, reduced the interest on outstanding loans to 0% for the indefinite future starting in March of 2020. And they basically waived required principal repayments. So if you have outstanding student loans with the feds, you have not had to make payments now for nearly 2 years. And Biden had been planning to end that repayment pause as of, I think, January 30th, so a few days from now. About a month ago, that policy was change of course to extend it, I think, through May of 2022 as of now.
Right. And Omicron was the justification for that extension. So we have this, I'll share this now, and this is kind of what got people in a tizzy. I mean, this is just a recurrence of a kind of a regular argument you hear from folks like this, which is that, like we said, it's for yuppies. But here, just to put it out there, is Justin Wolfers quoted, this said, almost a third of all student loan debt is owed by the wealthiest 20% of households and only 8% by the bottom 20%. And then you get this graph here, and who owns student debt by income and wealth quintile? And there's all these things like financial wealth, face value, excluding human capital. Like, what can you help? Like, what is this?
All right. So this graph comes from a recent publication by a guy named Adam Looney, who is actually also a professor at the University of Utah in the business school. So my counterpart department. And he has been a skeptic of student debt cancellation for a while now. He was the chief economist of the Office of Tax Analysis in the Obama administration, and had worked at Brookings, I think, before that and then after that as well, and then moved to the University of Utah. And he became a kind of student debt pundit as a result of a paper he wrote when he was in the administration and then published through Brookings after he left, that linked data on repayment that the Department of Education keeps, so student debtors and their history of repaying student debt, how much they paid over time, link that to tax returns that he had access to in the Treasury Department. So this was a paper that was published in 2015. It was highly influential and illuminating in some ways, though it certainly reflected a particular viewpoint that has become even more evident as time has gone on, and specifically in this most recent publication. Since then, Looney has not been able to conduct original research in the realm of student debt, because that publication turned out to have violated the Department of Education's rules on who is allowed to access their microdata, so data on loan repayment. And so not only can nobody replicate that study, nobody can do any other studies at all using the data that the Department of Education has, at least up to the present. I think I'm correct in saying they've not approved any further research. And so sort of all we have to go on, I mean, not all, because I've done my own research, but coming from official government sources, all we have to go on is what Looney was able to produce in that time when he was on the inside and which he can no longer produce. So this study, I mean, I want to talk about exactly the graph that you just showed and how it relates to the overall research on student debt. What you just depicted is a breakdown of the wealth distribution according and the bars in the graph are how much student debt is held by certain quantiles, it's called, so portions of the wealth distribution, like the bottom fifth would be the poorest, 20% of people, you know, the next 20 to 40% of people, and so on, up to the top 20%. And so you can see there, the blue bars are depicting what Looney calls financial wealth. And this is basically what this is. This graph suggests that there's one wealth distribution, but in fact, what's being depicted is three different ones. Financial wealth is the actual wealth that households hold. That is the number that's direct from the Survey of Consumer Finances, which is one of the few data sets that can be used to study student debt in the absence of the data that I previously referred to that we no longer have access to. That is a survey of households that says, you know, basically, how much is your house worth? How much is your mortgage? So there's your net worth is the difference between how much is your house and how much is your mortgage. It asks, you know, how much credit card debt are you carrying? How much auto debt are you carrying? What's the value of your car? So, you know, you could basically construct a household wealth distribution on the basis of the questions that are asked in the survey. And it asks people, do you have student debt and how much do you have? And so it's the way, I mean, I have used that data set myself to ascertain what portions of the wealth distribution have how much student debt and what's the ratio of household wealth of student debt to household wealth. Okay, so the blue bars in that chart are conceived the wealth distribution as exactly what's in the Survey of Consumer Finances. And it shows that the bottom 20%, the bottom fifth of households have the vast majority, or I guess just over 50% of all the student debt. And then the other 80% of households have a much lower portion of student debt. And by and large, those shares are decreasing. I mean, it looks to me like, you know, it's decreasing between the middle quintile and the top two. But if you just look at what's in the Survey of Consumer Finances, the takeaway is the poorest people have the vast majority of student debt. Okay, so that goes against the talking points that motivate this idea that student debt cancellation is regressive. So what Looney's done here is basically recalculate household wealth to include what he calls human capital, which says that people who go to college earn more than people who don't go to college. And so if we take the difference between those income, that future income between the college educated and the non-college educated, we will treat that as wealth. We'll basically add that up. So if you're a 30-year-old person now and you have some amount of student debt and your wealth is like zero or negative because of that student debt, instead of saying that's your wealth, that zero or negative number, we're going to say actually your wealth is the sum over your entire lifetime of the difference between what you earn having had a college degree and what you would have earned had you not had a college degree. We're going to add that up to the present, say that's your wealth, the same way that, you know, cash in your bank account would be your wealth. And then if we recalculate the wealth distribution that way, then it turns out that the people who have student debt have a lot more wealth, because according to Looney, that means they're going to have more income in the future.
Knock on wood.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, knock on wood is not a term that serious social scientists should be using ever in reference to their work. And yet that is basically the assumption underlying Looney's procedure there, because he's saying in the Survey of Consumer Finances, not only is your future income and the difference between that and what you would have earned had you not gone to college, not only is that not available to you now to repay your student loans, seemingly obvious problem there, it's implicitly using the income of people who are currently old to predict the income path of people who are not currently old. And the fact is there's a great deal of cohort effects in the income distribution. So if you're a 30-year-old person with a college degree and $50,000 of student debt right now, you're going to have a very different income profile in your life than someone who's currently 75 years old, has a college degree that they got back when they were, you know, 25 or 22 or whatever, you know, many years ago, and has subsequently earned, you know, some trajectory over the course of their lifetime. That the first is, or the second is not a counterfactual for the first. As any, you know, bare bones labor economist, or, you know, you don't have to be an economist to figure that one out. And yet that kind of shoddy work is being used to create the talking point on the part of Wolfers that you referred to. Like, all they want to be able to say is, you may have seen Steinbaum's or anybody else's publication that says canceling student debt is not regressive because it turns out that, in fact, it's poor people who have student debt. But you shouldn't believe that, you know, it's actually rich people who have it, and don't look too hard.
Yeah, like, get that on Biden's desk so he can be like, okay, well, then we won't do it, right?
Yes, yeah, exactly. And you can tell, by the way, that Biden and members of his administration have been talking about student debt, that this is really what they think. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, my job as an economist is to surprise people by telling them true things that are at odds with what they previously thought about how the world worked. I think that's kind of why I get paid a salary to conduct research. And I would say that what's going on here is that various credentialed social scientists have come up with ways to tell powerful people that what they already think is true, even when it's not true. The New Republic had a very interesting article this morning that referred to this situation that's here, where they quoted a executive of a for-profit higher education institution basically saying that he didn't want debt to be canceled because that would make him look bad, because institutions would have to confront the fact that their claims about their degrees leading to higher earnings would be false, because if they were true, then people would be able to repay their loans, and the reality is that they're not able to repay their loans. So all the political kind of rhetorical push is on the side of kick the can down the road, pretend there's not a problem. If people aren't repaying their loans, then come up with some way of disguising that fact, or just, you know, sort of pushing it into the future, not having the tough conversation like our higher education policy that's premised on individuals taking out loans in order to pay for college degrees so that colleges can expand and keep their enrollment up. You know, that policy is not has not been a success. And I don't think that the administration should be on the side of essentially not creating PR problems for for-profit higher education institutions, or for nonprofit ones, for that matter. Rather, many of their constituents and their voters have their lives being destroyed by outstanding student loans, and that should be the interest that takes priority in terms of policymaking.
Yeah, and what really galls me about this is the phony class politics. And we talked about this with actually the contractors too, but like the phony class politics in this case being, you know, we don't want to benefit those college-educated folks so much. Well, what you could do is relieve the student loans that force them to work for these like corporate jobs, and then tax them on the back end, right? Like, yeah, if you actually are concerned about that, that's the solution.
Also, we know that the Biden administration doesn't care at all about horrible class politics because Jen Psaki is still employed there.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, Dave, you want to say something?
Oh, no, I mean, I just sort of wanted to note there too, that, like, you know, the economics is one thing, but the politics of this from the folks who are, you know, against any kind of serious like student loan cancellation program. It's strange to me to see liberals so committed to this kind of, yeah, as Matt was saying, like phony class politics, because, you know, the solution to get around this is just to make things universal, right? Like, if it's a benefit that everybody enjoys, right, the potential of being able to go to, you know, 4-year university and get a degree, then you don't have to target or scapegoat or marginalize different groups, you know, about it, right? Like, that's the solution right there if you're worried about some people feeling left out.
Well, I think the opposite of what you just said has a long history in the politics of higher education, that we shouldn't have public higher education because most people who are college educated are situated in high class position. And so, say, for example, a public university system is in effect taxing non-college educated people, that is to say the citizens of the state, in order to create a benefit that is disproportionately accrued by the children of the well-off. And, you know, that is deeply perverse. Pete Buttigieg voiced a version of that in the Democratic primary debates, to much less pushback, frankly, than it should have gotten. The fact is, the only way a higher education has ever been egalitarian, if it could ever have been called that, is through being a public good and having admissions policies that make it possible for anybody who has the academic background and desire to get a degree to do so in the absence of considerations of their own net worth and their own parental background. That's what higher education as a public good means, and it is absolutely not regressive. Higher education not as a public good is extremely regressive. That's the situation that we have now, where the best resourced institutions are basically country clubs that decide who gets in on the basis of who your parents are, and you know, who can make donations and so on. And you know, there's been there's interesting research in higher education economics surrounding who goes to which college, that on the one hand, the higher education system is enormously stratified, and the more so as public institutions that are the part of it that were ever relatively egalitarian, as those are defunded and consequently come to act more as private institutions. That is to say, they want the students who are able to pay full tuition and who are going to earn the most coming out of it. And so that means admissions processes that select for that and exclude people from disadvantaged and not otherwise non-traditional backgrounds. That higher education system as a whole has become more stratified and inegalitarian as it has become less public and as public funding has been eliminated. I mean, it's from a tax perspective, it's also false to say that if you fund a higher education institution from a public budget, then that means that you're taxing the poor to pay for a benefit for the rich. I mean, I think a much better account of the politics of higher education at the state level is a revolt by the largely white tax base against any idea that the public institution might be accessible to people who don't look like themselves and the children of people who don't look like themselves.
And this is anecdotal, but, I grew up in the South, like a poor white kid in the South. And when I would talk to people about this issue about college, becoming more and more unaffordable for us, the retort you'd always get from the kids who grew up in the country club, golf clubs, is like, well, this is what happened because they started letting too many of, the government started forcing us to accept students who couldn't afford it. And then, college became unaffordable because of that. Right, because and then obviously the second part of that argument that they're not saying is that I don't think people like y'all should be going to school.
Yeah, right? Yeah, and exactly, and that is very much behind things like the Looney paper that Brookings published. It's like higher education should only be the preserve of the rich, and in order to keep it that way, we're going to say it already is the preserve of the rich to thwart any policy that would make it somewhat more egalitarian.
And this, I mentioned the Colonial Times earlier, but this reminds me of Governor Berkeley of Virginia, who was against any sort of education. He said it will bring disobedience, heresy, and sex into the world. And it's like that's basically like we still got that. We've brought that back. That's like we're going to punish you for having gotten an education, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that kind of say. I don't know exactly what dates on that statement, but I would guess it's. Reflective.
1700s.
Okay.
Or 1600s, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, 1600, wow, okay.
He was in the English Civil War, yeah. So
I was going to refer to Nancy MacLean's book, Democracy in Chains, and the treatment of John C. Calhoun and his politics that appear in that as a precursor to today's sort of libertarian anti-public good politics, because I think Calhoun rightly perceived that a state that has the wherewithal to provide public goods for its citizens is a state that has the potential, at least, to threaten the interests of the property-holding elite, and in his case, he meant the slave-holding elite. And I think that is a big part of the politics of anti-student debt cancellation and anti-integration and full funding of public higher education. It's like, we rely on these sort of societal institutions that perform the function of sorting the people into who's worthy and unworthy to be in our company. And we are against any type of policy that might throw open the gates of these elitist institutions to people who aren't like ourselves and that we don't want to see.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a couple things since we have you, I'd like to ask you about. I mean, one of the other arguments that they also, people who are against cancellation really rely on is the argument that medical professionals and lawyers, hold large amounts of school debt. And when we're talking about, if you basically exclude those groups, then the numbers don't look so bad. Is that the case?
Well, no, I mean, it's a tiny minority of student debtors, yeah, that are in those categories. Yeah, they do have a disproportionate amount of the total outstanding balance, but I would say a couple of things about that. I mean, as it relates to cancellation, mm-hmm. many of the people, you know, if your image of a student debtor is somebody who attended a very high tuition professional school and has a job in the private sector where they earn a huge salary, so they will eventually pay it back, so why should we cancel it? Those people have by and large refinanced out of the federal system, so they are not eligible for cancellation. The reason why they're able to refinance out of the federal system is because exactly because they're very good credit risks. A private lender can come along and say, okay, you know, the federal loans are cheap as unsecured debt goes. That is to say, they're handing out loans to people who wouldn't otherwise be able to qualify for them on terms that those people can at least barely afford, or at least can be contemplated to afford. And then the private lenders come in and say, you know, they don't originate student loans for people who are entering, you know, still paying tuition. Their niche is basically cream skimming the good credit risks among the federal loans and saying, we'll give you a lower interest rate if you refinance out with a private loan. And that is an offer that can only be made to people in the category that you said. And that, having taken that offer, they're not eligible to have their debt canceled anymore because the federal government doesn't own it. So, you know, that certainly should play into this distributional politics of this specific question of cancellation. As to the overall role that expensive professional schools play in higher education finance more broadly, and you know, how that affects the wealth distribution at large, you might say, you know, first of all, yeah, it's true that some people who go to such institutions might earn high salaries and have high debts. But the people who really earn high salaries, having gone to those institutions and especially having gone to the fanciest ones, are the people who didn't need loans to pay for them in the first place or may have already paid them off. So if you're looking at people with sitting on a large amount of medical school debt or law school debt, those may be people, first of all, whose parents weren't able to pay for their graduate school for them, or entered professions where they don't earn enough to retire those debts on the 10-year time scale that the federal system presupposes. So that causes, so either they enter income-driven repayment or something like that, that increases the balances over time rather than decreases them. And they're just not, like, the idea that people aren't repaying their loans. I mean, this is another, so Looney's paper, not only does it make this false assumption that your future income is part of your current wealth, it also makes the assumption that your current loan balance is actually the sum of your future payments, as opposed to the actual balance that it is. And this idea that it's the sum of your future payments says that if you're enrolled in income-driven repayment or otherwise in a program that doesn't require you to make your monthly payments, then it's as though your student debt doesn't exist, basically. Like, it's like, if you're not making payments on it, then the balance isn't there. And that's absolutely false as a statement of economic reality. I mean, it's kind of funny because he's taking it from a paper by two finance professors, one at University of Chicago Business School and the other at the Penn Business School. You know, that's not true on the basis of basic principles of finance, because it says that, you know, if you have your loan, say you never make any payments on your loan and are enrolled in an income-driven repayment program and have your balance forgiven in 20 years, which hasn't actually happened for that many people, you know, because the programs aren't that old. But suppose that the program operates exactly as designed, which is the assumption of that paper. That's saying that a cancellation of your outstanding debt in 20 years is worth the same to you as not having that debt right now, which is, as if you're familiar with basic principles of finance and time discounting, that is absolutely not a principle that finance professors should be adhering to in any context. But, you know, any supposed rigor and consistent assumptions go out the window if they need to serve the ultimate ideological conclusion of, oh, actually, student debt isn't that bad, and we'll basically put whatever numbers we have to down in order to be able to cite something in support of that point.
And I'll tell you, I mean, the politics of it truly does, like, it boggles the mind, because you can see how this could really, when you bring it to people, be extremely popular. Like, maybe some people at the Brookings Institution can get, like, really worked up about it. I don't understand, like, as in terms of, like, getting votes, who this is really working for. But on top of that, like, the funniest thing is on Twitter, if you ever sort of, you know, push back against these things, there is a certain kind of class of, like, neoliberal character who loves to go through all of the different repayment plan options that you have, and what are there, like, seven or eight of them, right? And I can't imagine more of, like, a neoliberal hellscape kind of solution to this big social problem than, like, no, you need to pick, like, out of these eight different plans and educate yourself on what happens over the next 30 years and hope that you make the right choice now so that you can be able to, you know, make big
purchases later in life.
Like, yeah, and you know, unlike these people who have an axe to grind, scholars who actually study the income-driven repayment programs that you're referring to show that the people who make use of them are, in fact, disproportionately on the better-off end of things in the student debt scale, exactly because if you have more outstanding loans, then it's worth more, or more higher balance outstanding, then it's worth more to you to actually figure that shit out. And also that, you know, this is like, as we've seen in the implementation of countless social programs, you know, if you make the eligibility requirements as minute as possible in order to please the wonks at the Brookings Institute, you're not going to have a very effective social program because it just takes so long for actual human beings to figure out how to navigate it. And many of them don't and won't because they rightly feel that they don't have that much to gain from navigating an opaque and dysfunctional system.
What should the model be? You know, I'm thinking back to when I was in the UK for a little bit, like 2013, fact-checking, 2011. This was right after Clegg got just blown out because of the tuition fee thing. And I was looking back at that, and it's like, they only instituted tuition fees in 1998. Should we just extend college like it's high school? What should a higher education be in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, it's useful to have the UK as this counterfactual for that, you know, things aren't inevitably the way they are in the U.S. The fact is that country chose to make their higher education system more like the U.S. higher education system starting in the 1990s, and especially over the course of the period 2000 to 2010, as you're referring to the coalition government at the beginning of 2010 or 2011. So Clegg had promised to rescind tuition fee increases that had been done on the previous Labor government, and then once he formed this coalition, he in fact tripled them in coalition with the conservatives on the same, you know, Buttigieg-like belief that charging higher tuition for higher education was actually an egalitarian policy because, that would mean that the working class, non-college educated wouldn't be paying for these elite educations for the children of the well-off who would be educated anyway. And they're in exactly the same situation we are now, which is that it didn't deter people from going to college because they had credentialization in the labor market happening contemporaneously. So lots of people did, in fact, more people did go to college and took out their huge student loans. And now the issue is on the repayment end. They're not having the repayments that they expected just the same way that we're not. To finally answer your question, what should our higher education system look like? You know, it should look like the system that the UK left behind, which is a public good where there's not that much of a diversity between institutions. So it's long been considered that a strength of the US higher education landscape is exactly that there's lots of diversity within it, meaning there's some place in it for everyone. That was supposed to be supposedly the reason why US had higher education attainment earlier than equivalent countries in Europe. So high school was universal in the U.S. More or less before World War II, other than black people in the South. That universal secondary education wasn't achieved in Europe until like the 60s or something like that. And similarly, with higher education, the U.S. had much higher rates earlier on. The view was it's because we have so many different institutions that there's a place for everyone in the system somewhere. I think in reality, a more homogeneous system is one that is more egalitarian, at least, where it doesn't really matter where you go to college. You know, forget this kind of admissions rat race that you get among the most elite institutions, you know, because that only tells you that there's this essentially arbitrary sorting going on where a highly significant decision is being made about you at age 18. It's also not, you know, that specifically, you know, very low, very highly selective, very low admissions rate type institution is not the experience of most people in higher education, but segregation absolutely is the experience of most people in higher education. The reason why there's such low admissions rates in the Ivy League is because it really, really matters which school you go to, at least when it comes to this social sorting. So my view is, you know, a good higher education system is one where, you know, it's basically a three-tier system like under the California Master Plan that created, you know, on the one hand, I mean, the University of California pre-existed the California Master Plan, but basically that's what instituted the system where you've got research universities, undergraduate teaching universities that offer four-year degrees, and then community colleges that offer two-year and professional degrees. And, you know, within that overall schema, there shouldn't be that much difference between the different institutions that sit in different ones of those tiers, nor should there be that different, you know, and I think that's that institutional homogeneity would lead to diversity and heterogeneity among the students at those institutions. So institutional heterogeneity in the existing system leads to segregation and homogeneity in terms of who goes to which institution. And I think the converse is true in a more fully public system.
Yeah, and I just want to circle back to that Clegg point about, you know, like, yeah, let's look out for the non-college educated. It's like, well, how about we take some concern that their wages haven't been rising, or in this country, like, give them health care, or stop their rent from increasing, or if at any point they want to, you know, stop and go get an education, like maybe when they're like in their 30s, they can go do that. Like, I would love to see that from higher education. Like, it's something that's open to everybody, not just, like you said, like this thing that sorts you after high school.
Right. And I was just having this conversation with my friend and colleague, Cedric DePaul, about the sort of vanishing phenomenon of the mid-career or late-career enrollee who is basically just interested in seeing, getting a degree, maybe, you know, whether or not they had one from when they were so-called college age, they might be interested in getting one now. And, you know, if it costs $30,000, they're not going to do that. But if it costs $3,000, you know, that's something that somebody might do because they're interested. Like, that is a beautiful vision of what a public higher education would look like. And, you know, it's basically vanished.
And that will lead to less resentment between this college educated, non-college educated, that I think, like, these folks are really trying to, you know.
Yeah, they're trying to like throw gasoline on the fire. And, you know, I don't know. I think Looney went to Dartmouth and Harvard. You know, the set of people who think that higher education is supposedly this elitist phenomenon that shouldn't be open to anybody who isn't like themselves. You know, you can tell where they came from.
That's funny. Well, Marshall Steinbaum, thank you so much. Folks, you can follow you on where can people follow you on Twitter?
My handle is econ_Marshall.
econ_Marshall, folks. One of the best econ followers on the Twitter Twitter feed. So check
that
out.
If you like roasting Justin Wolfers and other pseudo economists, please do come follow me.
Left Reckoners love that stuff, so I'm sure they will. Oops.
That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I really appreciate Marshall's perspective on these sorts of things. Particularly, I mean, people should go back to when we talked about Nancy McLean being right. It's a very important topic, the way that this stuff was. Now, this is politics, political economy, folks. Let's think about
the choices that are being made. No, exactly. We're bringing the politics back to economy, baby.
Yeah.
Much needed.
So we have some topicality, David. Before we get to our JP discussion about, you know, the new sort of thought coming out that's really taken the science world by storm, we have a new Jen Psaki. And just for me, she's talking about student loans here. This is straight from the Debt Collective. And actually, I haven't watched this, but I've just seen people react to it, so we can react to this in real time for folks.
White House plan to release the memo? Like, does the White House plan to tell the public whether it thinks has the authority?
So release the memo, and it's a little bit quiet because the report's not mic'd up, but when they're asked about release the memo, there's a memo that the White House has been sitting on for that's been totally redacted. There's been FOIA'd, but then it's been redacted with a giant pink redaction about what it actually said, about whether the White House has authority to cancel student loan debt. Spoiler, they do. Right. And so it's this big bureaucratic MacGuffin bullshit that we have to, like, oh, what is the memo said? It's just another way for them to, you know, pass the buck. and this is the memo comes from the same place as the parliamentarian, right? There's just magical things that crop up that stop the Democrats from delivering for the people of this country.
Well, as I said, again, we're still looking at administrative options, but Congress can also send the president a bill that would provide $10,000 in debt relief, and he'd be happy to sign that bill.
Now, that is also very interesting. And this is why this posture of deferring to Congress is bullshit. Congress, Elizabeth Warren, and even Chuck fucking Schumer say $50,000. That's what our bill would be. So instead, Psaki is dictating to them what they need to do and then saying, but that's in their hands. It's like, well, which one is it? Of course, you know, this is a better press corps would maybe drill down on some of these contradictions. But, you know, this is the type of mendacity you get from Jen Psaki. And just a little bit more, I think.
On the trip.
Okay, yeah, no, that was it. So Jen Psaki.
Then. Damn, oh. I thought she was gonna say that she's been listening to Marshall and actually thinks that it's time to time to pull the plug, baby. I mean, I've been trying to be more positive these days, but I'll tell you, sometimes it can just fill one with rage when you remember that every day they wake up and they choose not to help people.
Not to do
like
it.
Every day they could, you know, take a little piece of a little pen and a little piece of paper and like change people's lives for the better immediately. And they choose not to. Instead, you know, we have to hear all these, you know, poems about, oh, I hope the parliamentarian's like heart will change, or we have to read the memo. And we've been reading this memo and we've been thinking about this memo and we've been praying to this memo. It's just an absolute joke. I mean, look, and remember, you know, just for anyone out there who is not normal and is like a kind of insane nerd who's flipping out about this, like, no, the procedures. It's amazing to see what parts of the Constitution and our executive, executive powers are followed, which ones aren't, right? I mean, when it comes to Congress completely acquiescing to the executive branch, when it comes to war powers, right, there is no real big hubbub about that. There is no parliamentarian, or we need to really think this one through. There is an order from the executive branch to go and bomb those people. And then, a check is written,
pay
for the expenses.
This procedure coin, look how many times heads flip it. See how many times you flip it and it comes up heads in support of coercing workers in some sort of way. Right. Yeah. Oh, in support of imperial war machine. Yeah.
I don't know if you saw it, but I did a whole thing on this terrible essay. Yes. It's a video. People can watch it on this, essay in the Denver Post about crossing a picket line. And this person's going like, well, you know, people lose their jobs. It's not personal. It's just the market. Right. And it's like, who's in the market? It's people. People are making these decisions. And yes, they're personal decisions that affect people. Yeah. I don't know. It's always funny when they're like, oh, this is just how it is. You know, I wish something could be done about it.
I mean, honestly, like, it's pretty amazing that we've gone as a country from just saying like, oh, that's God that did that, to like, oh, it's the market.
But it's only liberals who do it too, by the way. Liberals and libertarians with the market, to be fair.
Jesus, it's insane. Really, markets, yeah.
Well, we took our dive into insanity. Now, can we please be enlightened by one of the most beautiful squishy minds of our time? That is Dr. JBP, Dr. Jordan Peterson.
Yeah, and I just want to shout out @TheBadStats on Twitter who urgently posted this video. They're a good follow for IDW idiocy. let's just play this clip. This is Jordan Peterson talking about climate, and he gets annoyed with the climate change types here, and let's hear what his concern is.
Hard to sort out. The climate change one is a weird one. So
that's because there's no such thing as climate, right? Climate and everything are the same word. And that's what bothers me about the climate change types. It's like, this is something that bothers me about it technically. It's like, climate is about everything. So, okay. But your models aren't based on everything. Your models are based on warming. A set number of variables.
Yeah.
So that means you've reduced the variables, which are everything, to that set. Well, how did you decide which set of variables to include in the equation if it's about everything? And that's not just a criticism. That's like, if it's about everything, your models aren't right.
Because
your models do not and cannot model everything.
What do you mean by everything when you say...
So...
See, that's the bit of Rogan that I love. He just is going to let you go and keep you going. He's not going to shut you down.
Yeah, like I think Rogan has a bunch of quacks in his ear about coronavirus, and I think people should criticize him for that. But I do want to point out that somebody did say that he did push back on a couple of different Jordan Peterson things in this episode. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's another thing that he's subjecting, you know, your friend who's a Joe Rogan head to 4 fucking hours of Jordan Peterson talking about, you know, what is climate? Everything. Is it my shoes? Like, is it my haircut? Does that need to be in the model, Jordan, for us to understand that fucking temperatures are rising? How about that? I mean,
Matt, your chaos energy is warming up the room right now.
I don't think it's so chaotic to think like, hey, let's have a graph that shows like years, Okay, that's interesting. One that shows temperatures and one that shows carbon in the atmosphere. Like, maybe, I don't know, maybe we need to model like what my cats are doing every day to get that, to really get everything, but I don't think that models quite need to be that sensitive.
Well, what's beautiful about, and I don't want to take this from you, Matt, so, you know, you go on with this, but like, what's beautiful about Jordan Peterson is his like merging of kind of traditional like conservatism, like we need to be drilling, 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 and like postmodernism, right? Yes.
As he's the poster boy of the guy against postmodernism.
The rationality, baby.
And yeah, like, and you know, actually, I do kind of need your help for this. So like the Baudrillard piece, the Gulf War didn't exist, right? Like I've never read that. I think I basically get the idea, right? Though that it's the framing of it as a war. Like it's like, you know, World War II or something. It was just, you know, shelling, right? And that sort of stuff, right? And so, and also like the way like we, you know, we maybe it's something about, you know, do we show bodies coming back or do we ban that? That sort of stuff. But like that's,
I mean, what, no, the po- that, I mean, that's the postmodern. Sorry.
Go ahead. No, yeah, go on.
No, I mean, like the postmodern, like what Peterson is doing in this clip is just funny because it's happening in, you know, not intro to philosophy classes, but this is like your 300 level philosophy class. You've taken a few classes and somebody started to read postmodernism, which, by the way, I'm not like even saying that this is like invalid to explore these kind of arguments, but essentially, you know, what these kind of things is like, whenever you see a kind of like authority, you need to challenge it, right? So whenever you're saying somebody's like, well, I'm modeling this experience, you know, we're going to challenge it. Maybe a better example of this, and this is way too like intellectual, honestly, for how stupid this Jordan Peterson is. But like, you know, like a common criticism would be something like in the philosophy of the mind, right? You look at when people say, oh, we have an understanding of the brain because we can like model and map it and we can, you know, and we can study it. And there'll be a picture of, you know, human brain with like different sections of it lit up. And, you know, the kind of like postmodern criticism is like, well, what does this tell you about anything? Or particularly, what does this tell you about this person or any of that kind of experience, right? You know, like it's challenging a certain kind of knowledge by pointing out what's lacking within it, right? Which again, like I think there's some serious limitations to that. I think a lot of people really get too excited. I'm not a postmodernist per se, but like I'm not going to say right now that it's like a completely, you know, ridiculous way, you know, a ridiculous like school of thought. What Jordan Peterson right there is doing though is ridiculous because one, he's asserting that people, whenever they're talking about climate, they're talking about everything, which I think, I don't know. I mean, it's such an abstraction. It's hard to even like tease out. But if I'm just going to be a little bit cheap and easy here, well, what they mean by being everything is they mean by like the ability of human beings to continue existing on this planet in the way that they do, Jordan. So yeah, yeah, no, I mean, it certainly does touch a lot of different things. Yeah, maybe they're not modeling GDP, and maybe that'd be something that you would like for them to be including in their models, or like maybe you'd get a very different result if you were including, you know, Exxon's profit margin in your kind of, you know, models for what the future will look like if we don't do anything. But I don't know. I mean, it's nitpicking because you know what variables they are including in there? The ones that fucking matter. Right? The temperature of the earth, the amount of precipitation that we're getting in different communities, the threat of wildfires, the sea level rising, right? Like, no, I mean, like, yeah, you know, I would prefer if we could have a complete knowledge, right? Like how happy I'm going to be. Maybe, you know, will I be able to make some money on the Cowboys next year or something like that, right? That'd be great if we can include that into the modeling too, and it was 100% accurate. But if we are living in a situation where we have incomplete, we have an incomplete ability to sort of map out the future, I would like to be able to map out the variables that make that prevent, you know, my house from being underwater in 10 years or my, you know, my childhood home from being burnt down by a preventable wildfire because the temperature in Texas has just gone up to 130 degrees a year. Right. I mean, come on, man, this is simple stuff. It doesn't take a brain genius to realize that, like, you can make some criticisms of modeling and hell, you know, who does that? Scientists, yeah, right? That's like the scientific
kind of their bags.
And I'll tell you, I mean, just that's the thing that's so funny to me about, I mean, there's a million things that are funny about Peterson, but like his like merging of like irrationality and like postmodernism, the big sins of our time, right?
with that kind of like IDW, James Lindsay, Barry Weiss, you know, like that whole like community. There's like, we're standing up for the Western values of like rationality and science and liberal capitalism, right? And then Jordan Peterson is like, you have to slay the dragon, and there is no kind of certainty in science, so that we can't know anything unless we know everything.
In his fucking bow tie, too.
Baller.
I like this tweet from Joseph Clark. Jordan Peterson is basically, mRNA vaccines can't claim to be sound and settled science, unlike, say, Jungian metapsychology. And I literally wrote, one time I was home in Bismarck, I was in an argument with Twitter from a Jordan Peterson fan who was literally trying to like prove to me some like frankly woo-ass shit about like the meta Jungian meta universe of like synchronicity and stuff. And it's like, look, man, I want Jordan Peterson to have his tenure to do this shit.
Yeah.
But I also think he should be able to tolerate maybe like gender and race studies down the fucking hall. And let's just cool down a little bit, because like, that's the thing. Like, he's right. Like, you're right. Like, he is more fun than a lot of these IDW folks. And I say that, like, of course, you know, noting sort of bigoted martyrdom for the trans folks. Like, obviously despicable guy. But like this thing where he is skeptical of their scientific progress thing, like where you have like Sam Harris was like, yeah, we're going to model the brain actually probably in 5 years and find out that Muslims are incompatible with democracy or something like that. Right. And Jordan Peterson's like, well, I don't think science can do that like that. It's ultimately these freaks, but can be entertaining sometimes.
I wonder where Jordan ate when he was here in Austin. I always think about that when dressed people go like on Joe Rogan. Yeah, what do you think?
what's the funniest place in Austin that he would go dressed like that?
Well, Joe Rogan's like favorite, because Joe Rogan lives out west, and like it's just such a classic thing. Like, he has the funniest barbecue restaurant that he loves, County Line, out there, which is not a bad place, don't get me wrong, but it's also like, oh man, this is like, you're from New Jersey and like you're still like sort of swimming in the mecca that is like Texas barbecue right now. And you're like, this is the greatest thing I've ever had. I do like to think about Jordan Peterson maybe going out there in his full bow tie, freaking out the locals. But all right, well, should we get on to this next bit? Unless you have anything else.
Yeah, you wanted, yeah, go. Yeah, let's get on to it. I think we're done with Peterson.
I mean, we might have more Peterson in the post game, which, by the way, to get the post game, patreon.com/leftreckoning. We got a lot of fun stuff going on in there, and we need your voicemail. So sign up on patreon.com/leftreckoning. You'll get the number and leave us a voicemail. Love to hear questions, comments. Maybe if you have a good Joe Rogan or Jordan Peterson impersonation, we'd love to hear that as well. Sunday we'll be releasing a conversation sort of debunking the IQ and genetic myths of the right. So you won't want to be missing that either. Patrons will be getting that. But before we go to the post game, we actually have another interview for everybody. One that I'm really excited to share with y'all. It's a conversation that I had with Bob Leibel, who is running here in Travis County for the Travis County commission spot, I believe in District 2, which might sound like a little bit of an obscure office, but it is essentially like, you know, the kind of broad strokes version of it is that it is like the city council for Travis County. And this really, really matters for people who live here, but also for everyone else, because as much as it drives me crazy, the rich and powerful have a serious interest in this part of Texas, and they are coming here in droves. And we need to have people in government who are looking out for the people in this community, and also making sure that those companies follow kind of basic safety practices, etc., that they're trying to come here to avoid. You know, they think they can come to Texas so that they don't have to look out for consumer rights or for their workers or pay taxes. So we'll get into that in this conversation. But I did just want to share very briefly with folks as we bring it up. I think people from here know about it, but if you're not from the area, you might not know about Tesla moved their huge gigafactory to Austin, where they're going to be building their Cybertrucks. I don't understand the attraction to those. I can at least, like, we've criticized the Teslas in general, but I can at least sort of get it. why you would want to drive those trucks around, I don't get. They look terrible. But anyway, that's not the focus of this.
Have they updated it at all? I guess it's not. But it still looks like a car from like a Nintendo 64 game. Like you don't have enough like fucking polygons. But anyway, go ahead.
But anyways, they came here and they're building this huge factory here. And this is not a unique thing to Austin, but they got a ridiculous and, in my opinion, criminal deal when it comes to the taxes that they should be paying. So I've read actually like much more detailed versions of this plan, and it is even worse than this. But this is just a kind of top line for people, so you know what we're talking about in this next segment. This was from 2020. So remember, this is when everybody was locked down. This is when we didn't know it was coming. And this plan and this deal was rushed through, I believe, in the period of a week, right? So the communities really did not have like the ability to speak up or to challenge this deal, because of course Tesla's, you know, saying we're going to have all these different places we could potentially go, despite the fact that Musk was already sort of here and is making very clear that he was going to be in Austin. Pretty disappointing, honestly, and embarrassing, as bad as it is here, to see what happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma, with the way that they tried to entice him to come over there. But we don't have time to do that right now. Let's read this first bit. Amid a frog drowning on Sunday, which is a great little turn of phrase, several dozen members of the Austin Tesla Club gathered jubilantly in a parking lot in East Austin. Masked fans cheered as a middle-aged man flashed the Bevo with one hand and fired a flamethrower with the other. The crowd was there to celebrate the deal between Travis County and the electric car manufacturer inked late last week to build a $1.1 billion 2,000-acre factory named Giga Texas in the tiny municipality of Del Valle near Austin Bergstrom International Airport. And let me just get to the details of this, because it is something else. This is the first sweetheart deal that they got, and probably one of the most damaging, was from the Del Valle Independent School District. As they note here, which received a C under the state's letter rating system, played an integral role in wooing the electric car manufacturer. The incentive agreement, in Tesla's case, the incentive agreement allows the company to cap its property value at $80 million. This is a property, that's valued at $1.1 billion. They are capping the property tax value of it for $80 million. That is money being taken out of that school system. That is money being taken out of kids' education, as opposed to its $1.1 billion valuation, meaning that Tesla will pay just $776,000 a year in property taxes for the first 10
What's
years.
What's that worth? That's nothing.
No. I mean, as opposed, wait for the next bit, Matt, as opposed to the more than $5 million it would pay without that tax break. The Tesla property's current tenant, a gravel mining facility, pays just $6,400 in property taxes. And few of the children of Tesla employees will attend school in Del Valle, whose population is about $17,000. No doubt about it, right? So what happens to that community? You see a massive increase. You see people getting essentially kicked out of their homes. The jobs, I don't want to spoil the interview, because the jobs that are being promised there are unfortunately like not that impressive. And again, you're taking out all of this money, millions of dollars, from a school system that really, really could use it to better the future for these kids. In other negotiations, this isn't in this piece, but Tesla has said that like, oh, well, we'll have some kind of after school program, and like, we'll send some people to talk to these kids. I would much rather $5 million be going into the coffers of our public schools here than having Tesla do some bullshit after school program. But this is the bit that's notable, because we're not talking about Del Valle's school system in this next interview, but this is Travis County. Travis County will give Tesla an additional property tax rebates worth $14 million over 10 years. If Tesla were to spend more in operational costs than $1.1 billion proposed, the company's subsidies would only increase this is the really crazy part about it. If Tesla were to spend more in operational costs than the $1.1 billion, the company's subsidies would only increase a 75% tax break for any spending between $1.1 billion and $2 billion, an 80% break for spending above $2 billion, right? This is why This is, again, not unique to this area. This happens all across the country, where corporations pit people and government authorities against each other so that they can get these kind of sweetheart deals. It is so damaging to communities. This is money that is coming out of children's education. This is money that should be being utilized to pay for the services that Tesla is going to be using and to improve the services of the overall community, right? If you want to be somebody who celebrates these big corporations coming into your community, you should want those corporations to be making sure that the roads, that the trash systems, that all of these kind of things that our tax money goes into funding is being fully funded by these corporations. The fact that Tesla was able to get this deal is an absolute disgrace, in my opinion. I'm really excited to share this conversation that we have with Bob Libel about his vision. And I highly, highly suggest that people check out his campaign if you're in the area. And if you aren't, I highly suggest considering donating as well.
Yeah. I mean, it reminds me of that Tyson plant that those people in Kansas opposed, because it's ridiculous that you're taking money out of people's, out of schools, like $750,000, nothing, man. Like, you're talking about operating a school budget.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, ridiculous. Absolutely disgusting. So yeah, here's this, interview. And, are we coming back after this, or are we going to see people?
We can come back and say bye.
Cool. Sounds good. I'll see you folks in about 20 minutes.
Welcome back, Left Reckoners. David Griscom here. Matt is AWOL. But I'm very, very lucky to be joined this afternoon by Bob Libel, who is running here in Travis County for the Travis County Commissioner. I believe District 2. Bob is a civil rights leader, community organizer, who's focused a lot of his work on immigration, mass incarceration, and he's also the former executive director of the Grassroots Leadership. I'm really looking forward to hearing his vision for Travis County. How's it going, Bob?
Good. Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm really thrilled. I mean, this is a really interesting race, and it's an interesting position. I mean, a lot of people probably aren't too familiar with what the Travis County Commissioner does or what that position is, but I think this is a really that's an important position for people here in Austin and Travis County in general. But this is one of those things where it's really important to understand how power works in your community and who are making these really, really big decisions that affect a lot of people. But, you know, could you just give people kind of brief breakdown of what that position is and why it's something that's actually very important for working class politics, people in the working class to be paying attention to?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So the commissioner's court, right, it's not a court, right, in Texas. The commissioner's court is like the governing body for the county, right? So it's like the equivalent of the city council for the county. And, you know, they're responsible for things like roads and bridges in the county, but they're also responsible for the budget for the entirety of the criminal justice system, which is actually the majority of what the county does. 60% or so of the budget of Travis County goes to prosecutors, goes to the jail, goes to defenders, and then goes to like sheriff's deputies. And constables, right? So as a criminal justice reform advocate, it's incredibly important, right? Because it's funding essentially the entire criminal legal apparatus outside of like your local Austin Police Department. And there's been a lot of fights in Travis County and over some of the big criminal justice reform initiatives. And then as we're talking about, you know, essentially how do we reimagine what safety looks like for communities, it's incredibly important. Right. One of the big fights is whether or not we go down a path. There's sort of this consultant driven study done in 2017 before we passed the Freedom City policy in Austin, before we elected Jose Garza as our district attorney, before a bunch of criminal justice reforms have reduced our jail population pretty significantly, that called for us basically tearing down our jails and rebuilding $600 million worth of new jails in Travis County. And the criminal justice reform advocates and others have said, let's take a step back, right, and actually figure out what our community needs. Maybe we actually need mental health and substance use treatment facilities outside of the jail, right? Maybe we need things like violence interruption programs. Maybe we need things like a bigger investment in public housing, right, as you know, things that keep people out of jail in the first place, rather than simply, you know, reinvesting in the system of mass incarceration. So that's been one of the big animating factors in our race.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, I want to talk a little bit more in a second about, you know, what can be done specifically with this position. But just for people, you know, who aren't familiar with you and your work, I mean, you know, what is your motivation in getting in into this side of politics? I know you've been a community organizer for a long time, but running for office is a different kind of game.
Yeah, absolutely. It was definitely nothing I ever thought that I would do. you know, my role has always been pushing the progressive policies and then organizing community around it. But it was really this fight over the jail that pushed me in. And, you know, essentially seeing how the big fight last summer was over the first step in that master plan, which is building a women's jail, right, in Travis County. And seeing how the community mobilized to delay that for 1 year, but also how, you know, our current leadership was not welcoming of that kind of input, right? It was not welcoming of the formerly incarcerated people who were speaking against the jail, right? Of the community organizations. And just seeing, you know, I think at city council here in Austin, there's been much more community organizing focused at it, but how the county commission, which spends more money actually in the general fund than the city does, right? And it has a bigger impact on things like criminal justice and in some ways economic development, right? Just doesn't have that kind of input. And so we're really running a race to increase the level of engagement of organizing that goes into the county, right? By really mobilizing community organizations and saying that people should have a vested interest in this. So it's not just about, you know, advancing progressive policy. It's also about expanding who has a voice in the decisions that really impact our community.
Yeah, because I mean, I like that a lot, and I think that as like a left movement, as a progressive movement, you know, as members of, you know, DSA organizations like that, not just saying that we just want, like, we don't just want to get people elected into office. We want to expand access to those kind of positions of power, and the commission, you know, make some very big decisions. I mean, one, obviously, as you were talking about, when it comes to mass incarceration for the community, but also when it comes to attracting or basically giving big tax breaks to, you know, certain kind of wealthy corporations, right? And that's not really a process that is extremely transparent or really incorporating too many working class people from Austin right now, is it?
Yeah, not at all. I mean, you know, I think our current county judge, Andy Brown, is doing a good job of trying to at least say what's coming up at the commission, right? But I mean, historically, there's been essentially no input even to the budget, right? I mean, there, you know, you show up to the budget hearings and there's basically no one even knows what Travis County is doing. And, you know, the what you're referencing, right, is the $14 million in tax breaks that Travis County gave to Tesla, right, to move their sort of their gigafactory here, which sort of precipitated the move of the Tesla headquarters here. And by all accounts, the county just got played, right? I mean, they broke ground the next week on the factory. You know, all the people who do the actual research on whether these subsidies are active say that in 85 to 90% of the cases, the company was already going to move here anyways, right? That it's just kind of extracting resources from the public, right? And in this case, to subsidize literally the world's richest man. And I think it's also worth noting that this was done in the summer of 2020, right? This is during the protests over, you know, our national reckoning over racism in the criminal justice system following the murder of George Floyd, when we're in the midst of the worst of the pandemic and the economic meltdown that it's caused. So while the county struggled to get its rental assistance program up, it rushed the process to give Elon Musk tax breaks. And to me, that over the objections, right, of organized labor and community organizations like the Workers' Defense Project, who said, if we're going to do this, let's at least slow it down, right? And like develop a process by which we can ensure that these are good jobs with occupational safety, right? Regulations baked into it, right? Where we have third party oversight, all the things that you would want in any kind of agreement. And instead we rushed it over the objections of organized labor and those community organizations and got it done in a couple of weeks because Elon Musk was threatening to move to Tulsa. And, you know, I think like looking back on it, that feels a little bit like, you know, a middle schooler talking about their Canadian girlfriend, right? Was Elon Musk really going to move to Tulsa, Oklahoma? Probably not, right? But he did get $14 million of public tax breaks out of the deal. For jobs that start at $35,000 a year, right? The fast food taco place around the corner from me is paying $33,000, you know, $5,000 or something like that to start, right? So these aren't exactly jobs that are living wage jobs for people trying to make it in a city that's so quickly becoming unaffordable.
Well, I mean, that's the thing about this Tesla deal that is so frustrating is one, the timing of when it was pushed through, two, how quickly it was done, and three, you know, at a certain point, you're just taking these companies at their word. And that's one thing. And this is not unique to Travis County, but this is all across the country now, where whatever the relevant body is just accepts like, oh, well, they're saying they're going to bring, you know, 1,000 jobs here and they're all going to be paying this much. And that doesn't typically pan out. And even if it does, like, should the county be subsidizing, as you were saying, these extremely well-off companies when there is an affordability crisis? I mean, could you talk about that as well? I mean, your personal feelings on what's been happening in the region and in Austin over this, you know, past couple of decades, honestly, when it comes to affordability, in particular parts of the eastern parts of Austin and the eastern parts of the county.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the thing that we hear over and over again as we're knocking doors, right? Is mm-hmm. that people are afraid that they're not going to be able to afford to continue to live here. I think it's hard to envision how people like my son, right, and, mm-hmm. and other middle and working class kids are going to be able to grow up here. We're really in danger of losing the ability for, you know, regular folks to live in our community. And, you know, we're the folks that make this place the interesting, vibrant, creative mm-hmm. place that people love, right? And if, you know, all of us have to be, you know, have to move to the exurbs, right? Can't even afford to live up in the edges of the city, right? You know, we're going to lose everything that we love about this community. And I think that as we knock doors, people see that, you know, and feel that really tangibly. And when we talk about Tesla moving here, right? I think that anxiety is just huge right now in Austin. I think that people are really afraid that we're going to become, if we are not already, right, the next, you know, San Francisco or Silicon Valley, right, where, you know, working people drive in for hours, where public school teachers can't afford, mm-hmm. you know, a place within, you know, 100 miles of where they work. And so one of the things we're saying, in addition to not giving mega corporations and the world's richest people tax breaks, is that the county needs an affordability and a housing plan, right? Complete mm-hmm. with a housing and affordability director position at the county that needs to be based so that we're coordinating things like our rental assistance, our anti-displacement programming, right? The funding to the courts that evict people, right? We should not have on one hand a court evicting people and on the other hand our rental assistance program that isn't being able to disperse funds quickly enough or effectively enough to prevent those evictions. Mm-hmm. One of the other candidates running on the DSA slate is Andrew Hairston, who's running for JP1 on an anti-eviction platform, right? So I think really working in concert with organizations like BASTA and the Austin Tenants Council, right, and groups like DSA, you know, to build momentum on these issues so that we are, you know, building a resistance to this kind of this anti-affordability crisis that we're all facing in our community.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to note too, because One thing, the affordability crisis is unfortunately like a national crisis.
Yeah.
It's really bad here, though. It's really bad here.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just want to note to folks who aren't from around here or anything like that, it's like, you know, one thing that I've always loved about being from here and I've always loved about this community is that, you know, Austin has always been a really great safe haven for people to come to. It has been a fairly welcoming place for people to come to. So not really trying to say that, like, you know, the problem is that people are coming here. It's more the question of, like, how are we going to do this in a sustainable way that doesn't come off of the backs of, you know, working class people, and particularly the communities of color that have been, you know, ignored for far too long in politics in Texas, and particularly in progressive politics, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Right. I am absolutely not a person who says don't move to Austin. Right. you know, there are some of us who are from here. Right. But most of us, right, have moved here at one point or the other. And it is, you know, that part of what has attracted interesting and creative and unique people to Austin, right, is the fact that you have been able to afford to live here, right? And I think that it is obviously, you know, a national and an international trend of things becoming unaffordable because of heightening inequality, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that one of the other things that the county needs to do, right, and that we all need to be doing is using the bully pulpit and all of the levers that we have, right, to increase union density, to ensure that, you know, all of our jobs, right, are keeping up with wages that allow people to be able to live in this community. You know, last year, Travis County employees got a 3% raise or a 3.5% raise, I think. And that was heralded as, like, the, you know, the best that they've gotten in years. Now, inflation was 6%. Housing costs in Austin, depending on how you measure it, went up like 20 or 40%, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, clearly we're not keeping up, right? And so I think that, you know, using every direct power that the county has to be increasing wages, and also the indirect power that elected officials have to be able to, you know, shame companies like Tesla, right? Who are paying not a living wage, right? At a facility that we got tax breaks for. It's not a living wage, at least if you're trying to raise a kid, right? In this community, right? To be using that bully pulpit for union density, right? And for increasing wages and benefits across the board.
I'll just say to listeners, again, if you're not from here, the Tesla deal, not just on the Travis County side, but with almost every entity that negotiated with him is frankly criminal. And, like, probably need to do a deep dive in that to break it down for people, because it's quite shocking. But in the last couple of minutes, this is a big part of this project, and just sort of thinking about how we want to engage with politics, particularly elected officials. Could you sort of map out? I mean, you were talking about other people, you know, who are running on the DSA slate. But, you know, how do you envision yourself if you're in this position? How do you envision sort of, one, interacting with the community, but in particular interacting with organizations like DSA and other kind of elected officials who sort of share a kind of world and political view with you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's been the work that I've done my whole life, right, is the sort of community organizing and building capacity, particularly in the communities that have been most impacted by mass incarceration and immigration detention and deportation. And that's how I envision, right, having an office at Travis County, right, that it would be the movement office at Travis County, where community organizations, where folks like DSA, you know, and where regular working folks, right, can envision themselves having a home and having a space in which they can move the issues that are important to them, right, and have a an advocate on the commission. And in many ways, it's very inaccessible, right, Travis County. Unlike the city council, where you'll often have the meetings are in the evening, right, where you'll often have community organizations mobilize dozens of people to testify, that very rarely happens at Travis County. There's been a couple of incidents over the last couple of years where the criminal justice reform community or, like, the tenants' rights groups have organized, but generally there's very few people that are paying attention, and we want to change that. right? So through things like ensuring that everyone knows what's coming up, through participatory budget processes, through making sure that agendas and documents are translated into the languages that are most spoken in our community other than English.
Yes.
We've translated our website into Spanish, but, we've had folks show up to testify, and the county, the county judge, who's like our mayor, has called up a staff member to interpret, right? And that's just like horrible practice, right? We should have an ability for people who speak languages other than English to be able to testify in front of our governing bodies in, this world-class community that we have. I think like really envisioning a more engaged, right, community. I think that's basic progressive politics, right? Like we should be bringing in people who've been excluded from the processes. And certainly working with folks like Andrew, Greg Cassar has been a good friend and a champion of so many of our issues on the city council. Hopefully he'll be our congressperson. I think that there's a really good sort of slate of DSA candidates and other progressive candidates here in Austin and Travis County. And a lot of that is because the movement has been built here, right? The sort of the groundwork has been laid for community organizing and electoral politics in a way that is really unique, I think, and really speaks very highly of our city, for our city.
Absolutely, and I'm very excited. Bob, how can people get involved and donate?
Yeah, bobforcommish.com is the website, and it's Bob for Commish on all the social media channels. So we would love that if people can get engaged. The election is March 1st, and early voting starts on Valentine's Day. So we're really in crunch time. We're knocking literally thousands of doors as we speak. So you can sign up on the website. Certainly donations are really appreciated so that you can pay. We're the only campaign in the race with a labor peace agreement. We like have living wages for all of our campaign workers. So donations are very much appreciated so that we can pay people to go out and knock doors. But we're also doing text banks, postcards, phone banks over the next few weeks. So you can sign up to get involved that way as well.
Well, that sounds great. Well, Bob, I really appreciate you taking the time this afternoon, and people should definitely check out the website.
All right. Thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's interesting about the way the municipality is set up there in the county.
It's because Travis County includes all of Austin, but all of Travis County is not Austin.
Right.
So, and it can get sort of funny. I don't mean to bore people, but it is like there, especially south where I'm at, like the lines aren't always clear because sometimes it goes a little bit further south. Like it's not just like you just hit like a straight border, and a lot of people like they think they live in Austin and they actually don't.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah.
They find out when they go to vote or something like that. And they're like, why is there no mayor for me? But in all seriousness, Bob, I highly suggest people checking out that campaign. And I think beyond anything, like, this is one thing that Austin DSA is very good at, actually, has been locating sites of struggle. Bob, comes out of this fight against mass incarceration and for justice for immigrants and recognizing that, the Travis County Commission plays a very big role in selecting how much money is going into, these prison systems in the area. So if we want to be lobbying and changing that system, we need to be addressing the power itself, right? And like, this is that kind of second level move that I think as we're growing a much more, experienced left in this country, this is how we go from moving in the Leo Panitch, Sam Gindin style from protest to politics, right? So much of this energy is like brought up in these, the struggle, in Black Lives Matter and against police brutality. But then the second question is like, okay, so we have the protests, we have the people here. What do we do next? And recognizing places that, we can sort of enter and change that system is very helpful. So I hope people found that interview interesting, even if you aren't
you know, invested in the area, because it really does show how you can sort of be strategizing about what's going on in your community as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's nice getting a little a set of these. We had Paul Prescott on earlier about Pennsylvania, and yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
We also, I just want to tease, I guess, unless you want to add anything else, we have some Sarah Palin footage that we're going to play. She just tested positive for COVID 2 days ago, and she's seen out at restaurants. So we'll play some of that. Your voicemails. We're going to actually get to a lot of them. We didn't get to a lot because we had the massive 3-hour marathon with the band last week. That people, yeah, if you're not a patron, you've got to go check that out. Went deep with on Hitchens to like 1 a.m.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
It was so good. Drinking.
We'll be bringing that energy to this one too. So join up patreon.com/leftreckoning, talking why the IQ and genetics argument, so often brought up by the right, but equally worrying and prevalent by these kind of very, very rational guys like Sam Harris.
Just let me do my science. Stop criticizing me about your insinuations about, who I'm. We'll get into it. Yeah.
We'll be getting into all of that. So join us up at patreon.com/leftreckoning. We'll be on the other side pretty soon, a little bit sooner than normal, since we had some pre-recourse today.
Yeah, we'll be going by at 10:30, folks. See you in 15.
See y'all soon.